Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is going to be holding a national conference on August 18th and 19th in Newark, New Jersey. And that's going to be called Obama, the Elections, and the Struggle for Peace, Justice, a Better Life, and Black Power.
Uhura. And you can go to the website, blackisbackcoalition.org, and there's information up about it there.
And you're going to be seeing a lot of people talking about Obama and the Republicans and the RNC and the DNC and the elections and everything. And this conference is a very important place to get real analysis from the Black is Back Coalition, anti-imperialist organization, the first African organization that protested the Obama administration when it was very unpopular to do that. This conference is really going to go into the issue of the electoral process and how the electoral process should best be engaged by African people to further the cause of African liberation. So I'm you know, really excited for that conference, and just want to encourage people to go on blackisbackcoalition.com and read more about that and plan to attend that conference. So we're going to close out. I want to, again, appreciate APSC Chairwoman Penny Hess for being on the program with us today.
Uhuru, and it was great to be here. Uhuru, Jesse.
Uhuru. And I also want to call on everyone that's listening to join the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Go to uhurusolidarity.org and become a member of USM, the only mass organization that works in a principled relationship of solidarity with the African Liberation Movement, working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. And also, tune in next week, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern, on uhururadio.com for Reparations in Action. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in and say Uhuru.
Uhuru.
Hey, yo, we meet with families. Tell mothers not to cry.
Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
I'm going to Louisiana and get me a mojo hand. I'm going to Louisiana and get me a mojo hand. I'm going to fix my woman so she can't have no other man. Cold ground was my bed last night. Rocks was my pillow too. Cold ground was my bed last night. Rocks was my pillow too. I woke up this morning, I was wondering, what in the world am I gonna do? I lay down thinking, about me a mojo hand. I lay down thinking, about me a mojo hand. I didn't want to fix my woman so she can't have no other man. But don't let your woman fix you like mine fix me. Don't let your woman, boy, fix you like mine fix me. She'll make a fool about her, about as a fool can be. Now can a woman act funny when she got another man? Can't a woman act funny when she got another man? You know she won't look straight at you. This is always reading sand. I won't be gone long. I'm going tomorrow, but I won't be gone very long. I'm gonna get me a mojo hand. I'm gonna bring it back home. That's what I'm gonna do.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And we are in a blues bag. Today we have on our bluesologist cap, and we kick the show off with the music of Robert Nestor Marley, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and he did a piece called Talking Blues. And we also heard from Lightnin' Hopkins, and Cold Ground Was My Bed Last Night, Rocks Was My Pillow Too. That was a line that Bob Marley lifted straight out of the Lightnin' Hopkins songbook. But on today's show, we're going to have a very, very nice show for you today. We're going to be talking about the Yoruba religion at 2:30. At 3:30, we're going to be speaking with Standish Kwame Willis, who is a criminal defense attorney who was born and raised in Chicago. And we're also going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And Gerald Horn is a friend of Charles Roach, and Stan Willis is a friend of Charles Roach. And Charles Roach is an attorney who is suffering some health issues, and there's going to be a number of tributes to Charles Roach in Toronto, and we're going to talk about Charles Roach. But right now, we want to continue with some great blues music and just kick back, relax, and listen to some great music from Sonny Boy Williamson. This is one of Dick Griffey's favorite songs, Fattening Frogs for Snakes.
It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It sure did, man. But I bet you my bottom dollar I'm not fighting no more frog for snakes. I started checking. I found out my downfall from 1930. I'm telling all of my friends I'm not fighting no more frog for snakes. All right now. I got to correct all of my mistakes. Whoa, man, 1957, I got to correct all of my mistakes. I'm telling my friends, including my wife and everybody else, I'm not fighting no more frog for snakes.
It's a little number I had the pleasure of writing years ago, and it's very, very standard number. Now, everybody do this number, which makes me very happy because it put a little royalties in my pocket. But it makes me happy to know that I'm the composer, and it goes like this. They call it Stormy Monday. Tuesday's just as bad. Call it Stormy Monday, and baby, Tuesday's just as bad. Yes. Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's oh so sad. Well, the eagle flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out to play. Thank you. Friday and Saturday I go out to play. Sunday I go to church, pretty baby, and I kneel down and pray.
Clark's Hotel out there on Central.
Yeah, 18th and Central.
And you had a black, long black limousine, Lincoln limousine, and well, you had a song out there called They call it Stormy Monday.
Look out, son.
But Tuesday's just as bad.
Well.
They call it Stormy Monday.
Look out, JT.
Well, but Tuesday's just as bad.
You done got slick, ain't you, Pete?
You know Wednesday's worse. Oh, it's on so sad. But here, what I liked about the whole thing is that, you know the heat. Saturday, I go out and play.
Yeah.
No, leave the flag on Friday. Yeah.
Look outside. You gonna make me a hey.
But I like the part with this hat. Yeah. Like a good boy. My Sunday, I go to church.
Sunday, I go to church.
My dues.
What you do?
Lord, and I kneel down and pray.
Jay Z, tell her what you say. Look out, son.
You know
what you say?
You know I'm trying. Don't have mercy.
Don't have mercy.
Lord, have mercy on me. Well,
what you say?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to find my baby.
Look out, son. Listen. Should have had my fun.
Yeah.
Now if I never get well no more.
Go ahead, say it. Well, I had me fun. If I don't get well no more.
Take the time.
Go ahead, say it. My hair been getting a little gray around the edge. But that don't mean I'm going down slow.
Wait, I got something, Johnny.
And you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we were listening to the blues featuring Bobby Bland, Johnny Taylor, and Bobby Rush. We were listening to Stormy Monday, a song that was composed by T-Bone Walker, and we heard T-Bone Walker's rendition of Stormy Monday Blues, and we kicked that set off with Sonny Boy Williamson and Fattening Frogs for Snakes. And I would like to thank Chairman O'Malley and Chattel and Archie Shep, who made it possible for me to do Diasporic Music on the Uhuru Radio. The concept of Diasporic Music, I really got it from Brother Archie Shep, and Chairman O'Malley and Chattel allowed me the space to do Diasporic Music on the Uhuru Radio Network. Right now, we want to continue with the blues. We're going to give you a sister out of Chicago, Illinois. And we're going to have a wing dang doodle up in the Union Hall. And then we're going to hear from KRS-One. He's going to sort of hip-hop the same song. This is Coco Fila.
Right here, I like to do a little tune I had the pleasure of recording. I hope you remember and like. A little thing goes something like this. It's called Wang Dang Doodle.
dope, dope style by the master VDP Pro. Of course, I will now present to you a different view. The 1990s. Of course, 89 is behind me. So check it out. It's called breath control, breath control, breath control, style. Breath control, the love. Breath control, the love. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style. Breath control, the love. It's KRS-One, yes, the teacher. I wear clocks and holy night sneaker. In your speaker is the new style. A dedicated to the intelligent child. In the front row or behind me, we're gonna pull somebody far for the 90s. You want lyrics? We come correct. BTP, only moving with respect. The other MCs, they can't believe me. Or when I rhyme, it sounds just like a CD. We don't lip sync, we go all live. On stage, I bring about four or five. That's D.D.I., Sydney, and Melody. Or myself, Harmony, and Willie D. We come humble, we just rumble. While other MCs crew just crumble. They want dances, they want lighting. They want effects to make them look exciting. But it's frightening, cause without that, the whole crew is wick, 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 whack. BDP comes with the cheapest and perform miracles like Jesus. The total respect, we achieve it. And the big headliner can't believe it. It's called breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. Breath control, the love. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. Get ready for the break. Out. Also dope that you don't wanna miss out. We got pages of the dope stuff. So in the record store you can't pass by us. Get the album, hear the music, and hold on so you just don't lose it. As a reference for any MC that wanna test KRS-One, cause I've been watching these other rap groups. They walk around like they're some kind of big soup. You can't touch them, you only see them in an arena or a big coliseum. So when you watch them for a second, them sound nothing like they do on record. They sound cheesy, them sound wheezy. For $20, well you know them never please me. So I see this and prevent this. It's like going for a checkup at the dentist. Cause when you come to a BDP performance, the microphone had better have endurance. Cause we'll check it and then wreck it. And then the sound man has got to accept it. Because it's breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. Breath control, the love. Breath control, breath control, breath control, style it. Breath control, the love. Take it out.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, and we are have on our bluesologist cap today. We were listening to, that was KRS-One, or Boogie Down Productions. I think Scott LaRock was still in the land of the living at that particular point. And he did a piece called Breath Control, which he was definitely sampling Willie Dixon's Wing Dang Doodle. And we heard The Wing Dang Doodle by Coco Taylor, a great sister out of Chicago, Illinois. I saw her a couple of times here in Toronto, Canada. And right now we wanted to switch gears and bring you some food for thought. We're going to be listening to Tracy Hucks. She is a PhD associate professor of religious studies. And she's going to be talking about the, she has a book out called The Yoruba Traditions and African-American Religion, Religious Nationalism, pardon me. And she's going to be talking about the Yoruba religion and mentioning people like Catherine Durham and Zora Neale Hurston and many others. So let's listen to Dr. Tracy Hux.
Good afternoon. We're going to get started. I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon. I'm very excited that in honor of Women's History Month, Africana Studies and Gender and Women's Studies have teamed up to present this wonderful lecture this afternoon by Professor Tracy Hux from Haverford College. And before Jeffrey Eisenberg comes to give us the introduction of Dr. Hux, as a representative from Falvey Library, who is also co-sponsoring this event, I just wanted to alert you that Gender and Women's Studies has some materials on the back wall, and it's pre-registration time, and so they want you to make sure that you see the classes that are being offered. And also I wanted to invite you to go on the Africana Studies website for our future events. We've got one more event coming up in April, and so we want to invite you to that as well. So I want to thank Falvey Memorial Library for co-sponsoring this event for us and setting everything up. We also want to let you know that there are snacks in the back. Do not leave them. You've got to eat chocolate in the afternoon. So we're going to ask Jeffrey to come and introduce Dr. Hux. Thank you. Thank you again for coming.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Falvey Memorial Library. My name is Jeffrey Eisenberg, and I am Falvey's Programming and Outreach Graduate Assistant. On behalf of Joe Lucia and the entire staff here at Falvey, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's Women's History Month lecture. We here at Falvey are proud to bring our events to the Villanova community every semester, and we have several exciting programs coming up. Next Thursday, March 22nd at 5 p.m., you can join us here in the Speaker's Corner for NovaFesh, a celebration of Irish Heritage Month. The event will feature live music from the Philadelphia Cali Group, the Villanova Irish Step Dancers, poetry, and song. Also just around the corner is the next installment in the New York Times video conference series. This web conference on March 29th will feature New York Times national editor Sam Sifton, and soon after is our annual John Paul II Legacy Lecture. That's on April 2nd. Information on these and all of our events can be found on the library's website. For today's Women History Month lecture, we welcome Dr. Tracy Hux, Professor of Religious Studies at Haverford College. Speaking on her forthcoming book, Poaching the African God, Yoruba Traditions and African-American Religious Nationalism, Dr. Hux will discuss women and religion in the African diaspora. She has previously published an article on the topic as well, entitled, I Smooth the Way, I Open Doors, Women in the Yoruba Orisha Tradition of Trinidad. We'd, of course, also like to thank Africana Studies for helping us make this event possible. And with that, please welcome Dr. Tracy Hux.
Good afternoon. I want to thank Dr. Lucky for this gracious invitation to come all the way from Haverford College, all those 3.5 miles up Lancaster Avenue, to be with you this afternoon. I also want to thank Africana Studies and the Women and Gender Program, and also the Falvey Memorial Library, and also Mimi, a wonderful face that I reconnected with here at Villanova. My presentation today, Yoruba Traditions and African American Women's Narrative, is closely related to aspects of my larger book project, Yoruba Traditions and African American Religious Nationalism. It is a history of African Americans and their practice of Yoruba traditional religion, a tradition originating from the Yoruba ethnic group in southwestern Nigeria, and my book spans the period from 1959 to the present. This research is a combination of both archival and ethnographic fieldwork conducted in Nigeria, in Cuba, and throughout the northern and southern regions of the United States. In my capacity as a historian of religion, I work on those traditions referred to pejoratively in American and in international popular culture as voodoo, hoodoo, obia, black magic. Those are some of the pejorative words you hear about the traditions I work on. But more correct and precise terminology to identify the African-derived religious traditions I study would be Vodou, Lukumi, or Santeria, Candomblé, Shango Orisha, Ifa, or Yoruba traditions. These African-derived cultures practice throughout North and South America, the Caribbean, the United States, and other geographical locations in the world that, of course, include Africa, are not new but very old, dating back in this hemisphere to the importation and diaspora of African captives during the slave trade, with continued fertilization throughout the 19th century. These traditions maintained over centuries, and often through Catholic and Protestant surrogate traditions, were ways of maintaining an African sense of identity and humanity in the face of the dehumanization processes of slavery and its aftermath. They have continued to persist throughout the Americas, the Caribbean, including the southern United States. What made these traditions so significant among newer African peoples was their ability to maintain spiritual linkages with the continent of Africa. According to historian of religions Charles Long, Africa functioned as a metaphor of self-determined legitimacy for Black diasporic citizenry and allowed them to assuage often ambiguous understandings of belonging and identity and origins. Long argues in the New World context that even if there, quote, was no conscious memory of Africa, the image of Africa played an enormous part in the religion of the Blacks. He goes on to say that the image of Africa, an image related to historical beginnings, has been one of the primordial religious images of great significance. It constitutes the religious revaloration of the land, a place where the natural and ordinary gestures of Blacks could be authenticated, over and against depreciative images of Blackness pervasive throughout the New World. These African-derived religious traditions emphasize African ways of cosmology and engaging the sacred world that includes a supreme creator in Yoruba tradition called Olodumare, a belief in spiritual deity called Orisha that often manifests themselves in the natural world. So these Orisha you'll find in the natural world of the river, the ocean, the forest, thunder, wind, vegetation. And also, there's an active engagement with these spirits as they are appeased with food offerings and at times animal sacrifice. They are ritualized through song and dance and chants. There's a strong and common belief within this tradition and a closeness to one's ancestors, believing that they could still continue to live among those who are on this earthly plane. There's also an understanding of the world that includes healing with spiritual and herbal pharmacopoeia, with the understanding that illness and affliction have both a physical and a spiritual causation. And finally, a belief that one's destiny is never fixed, and that there is the ability to perform divination readings as a way of using human agency to constantly negotiate one's future and one's destiny. I come to the study of African diasporic religions in the tradition of previous generations of African American women and Guggenheim recipients like Catherine Dunham, who you see here in Haiti, who conducted extensive field work in Haiti, Jamaica, Martinique, Trinidad, and Tobago, and also in the tradition of Guggenheim recipient Zora Neale Hurston. Throughout the 1930s, Zora Neale Hurston conducted ethnographic research on traditions such as Vodun, Hoodoo, and Conjure throughout the North American South and also throughout Haiti and Jamaica. Those of you who may know her work, Tell My Horse, is a compilation of her anthropological research in Haiti and in Jamaica. We know her mostly as a novelist, but she did some outstanding ethnographic work in the early 1930s that still has importance today. Hurston's careful documentation of African-derived practices in the United States and the Caribbean helped categorize African practices as legitimate, sophisticated religion, reflecting what she called the old mysticism of the world in African terms. And that's significant that she calls this legitimate, sophisticated religion, because these practices were often relegated to a realm of magic, to something outside of the realm of religion. And for her in the 1930s to want to use a kind of categorical analysis of religion was very important. It can still continue to be very important in the historiography. For Hurston, African-derived practices in the New World were ultimately, in her language, religions of creation and of life. Dunham and Hurston's religious worlds did not remain untouched by African-derived religions, and both of them, throughout their fieldwork, were formally initiated into voodoo religious traditions. Paradoxically, evidence of Hurston's creative use of her knowledge of voodoo appeared in the proceedings of her 1939 divorce trial. The proceedings revealed the permeability of voodoo and its ability to be invoked as an avenue for spiritual control. And this is actually from Zora Neale Hurston's divorce records. And the defendant is her husband, her ex-husband. And according to the records, it says the defendant was also put in fear of his life due to the professed black magic or voodooism claimed by the plaintiff, Hurston, to have been acquired by her while living in Haiti, and that she had the power, both in spirits and in the use of certain preparations, to place individuals under certain spells, and that if the defendant would not perform her wishes, she possessed the power to fix him. So I bet these proceedings went quite smoothly, and he gave her the divorce that she wanted. Hurston and Dunham's writings and the details of their own religious journeys provide concrete evidence that African-derived traditions were integral components of African-American women's lives in the early decades of the 20th century. My own research in African-derived religions begins in the late 20th and continues through the 21st century, the first decade of the 21st century. African-American women who encounter African-derived religions in North America often attest to profound experience of affirmation of both their blackness and their femaleness. African-derived traditions such as Yoruba offer a means of explaining new possibilities of black womanhood, as such exploration relates to the reverence of female deities. So they will talk about the connection of what it means to be a part of a tradition where the image of deities look like them. It takes on both their racial and their gendered understandings. Many African-American women have found this affirmation lacking in other religious traditions in which masculine iconography of the sacred is privileged. Within African-derived traditions such as Yoruba, sacred representations are embodied and incarnated in both male and female forms and are imaged in African phenotype. The sacred female entity in the Yoruba tradition manifests itself in Orisha divinities such as Yemoja. You see here the goddess of the ocean and the sea. These are various representations of her. And also, what you'll also notice is associations to the maternal aspect of women also. And so these deities also manifest aspects of the women's lives who are their devotees as well. We also have Oshun, the goddess of the river, exuding sensuality and fertility. And also Oya, the goddess of the wind, representing dynamic power and fury. Within the lives of many African-American women, these deities function practically as sources of maternal energy and also of sisterhood. So you see an image of Oshun and Yemoja coming together in sisterhood, and theologically as female manifestations of divine power and authority. The essence of these female spiritual entities are kept in homes, in private shrines and altars. So here's an altar in a home for Yemoja. You'll see the colors that are representing the ocean. Often you'll find also some kind of container which contains some kind of initiatory spiritual essence of her on that. And one of the things about these traditions is it shifts kind of sacred space outside of our traditional notions of church or ecclesiastical spaces and moves it into the private home sphere and also into nature. And you'll see this is also offerings for Yemoja at the ocean. And in the process of ritualizing these deities, the human body acts as a host for the embodiment and manifestation of these deities through spirit possession. Anthropologist Karen McCarthy Brown, who wrote the book Mama Lola, said that one goes to a Christian church to find God. One goes to African religious services to become God. And so the understanding is that the body becomes the human space, the human cavity for the Orisha to come and actually manifest itself among humans and speak through the human form. In an interview with one African-American woman in 2006, I asked why she, as a North American woman, found herself attracted to African-derived religious traditions like Yoruba. She replied that she did not want, these are also ceremonies of Oshun and one of spirit possession. She replied that she did not want to be a part of any religion that did not allow her to honor her female ancestors, and needed a religion that enabled her to preserve her gendered authority and presence in her life. It was also important for her to be a part of a tradition where female Orisha deity governed areas of knowledge and sources of knowledge that both men and women needed, not just to survive, but to thrive. Like many African-American women, she was drawn to what she viewed as alternative sources of women's empowerment, leadership, and authority. Contrasting her Christian background, she states, "When you're coming from parts of the diaspora where women can't even stand in a Christian pulpit, the Yoruba tradition marks a significant shift in the role of women in leadership and in the ritual life of the community." And so part of heads of many of these religious organizations devoted to these deities are headed by women, and it becomes a space unlike other traditional Christian spaces where women are in the leadership role and women are in the governance roles as powerful leaders within the tradition. A significant portion of my field research in Yoruba religion and in North America was conducted over several years in Oyutunji African Village. And this was the founder of that village in 1970. His name is Oba Asurjimin Adefume. Oyutunji Village was founded in 1970 in the Gullah Low Country of South Carolina as an autonomous African village devoted to the practices of African-derived religions. Oyutunji was founded in the aftermath of the Black Power and Black Nationalist movements that often stressed territorial nationalism, with its welcome sign reflecting this sentiment. So when you go to Oyutunji Village, you'll find this sign at its entrance. It reads, "You are leaving the U.S. You are entering Yoruba Kingdom. In the name of His Highness Efintola, peace. Welcome to the sacred Yoruba village of Oyutunji, the only village in North America built by priests of the Vodun cult as a tribute to our ancestors. These priests preserve the customs, laws, and religion of the African race. Welcome to our land." Since its inception in 1970, Oyutunji has been a residential community devoted exclusively to African religious and cultural practices. Within Oyutunji Village, family networks and gendered notions of power have often been played out within the complex marital partnering of plural marriage. Polygyny, as a legitimately recognized form of West African marriage, is openly practiced as a choice in social experimentation in Oyutunji Village, with the founding Oba having had multiple wives and close to 24 children over the course of his lifetime, and he passed away in 2005. The state of South Carolina has never legally recognized these polygynous units, although one of the chiefs said that they were working in the process of negotiating with the authorities to recognize their marriages contracted in the Yoruba traditional way. Regardless of its legal status, polygyny has held considerable cultural meaning within the Oyutunji community. According to the late village's king, under the system of polygyny at Oyutunji, a man is allowed to marry as many wives as he can afford. If a man does marry more than one wife, there are certain obligations he has to meet. The Lord Oyutunji states that when a man marries a woman, he has to build her a house, he has to create an ancestor worship, he has to give her enough money to start a business of her own. Whereas many African cultures view polygyny as a sign of wealth and prosperity, its leader maintained that in Oyutunji it functioned much more pragmatically as a means of increasing the family unit, dividing labor responsibilities, protecting women from childlessness, and ensuring African posterity. I found most revealing the reflections and responses of African-American women in Oyutunji who comment on the choice to engage in plural marital contexts. For example, one woman who lived largely in an urban context before residing at Oyutunji stated that before she became a priestess and moved to Oyutunji, more often than not, the men she dated, quote, always had somebody on the side. She eventually decided would enter in the Yoruba kingdom. Why fool myself? At least polygyny is in the open. You know what you're dealing with. You know the men usually don't want nobody else because in the Yoruba culture, they can only take as many wives as they can afford. So I figure, what the hell, I'm going to try it. Another one of its residents spoke favorably about her own experience with polygyny. She valued having space to explore her own pursuits and never really liked for a man, she said, to be all up under her all the time. This sentiment, coupled with the fact that she was not a possessive person, she says, made a polygynous relationship conducive to her independent lifestyle. In addition, another resident who spent 15 years in Oyutunji and was married to the founder when she was actually one of seven wives at that time, is clear about articulating the real challenges faced by women within the context of plural marriage. Yet she says she was often able to reflect on the ways women sought their own means of empowerment through gaining access to political and social authority, forming lasting bonds as co-wives, cooperative systems of support, spiritual mentorship, and in her words, cohesiveness and camaraderie around among them. Some North American priestesses, however, ultimately view polygynous marital configurations as a form of socio-political control with the ability to lessen women's spiritual potentiality, potency, and opportunities to be unfettered priestly specialists. Despite these views at Oyutunji Village, plural marriages are said to function as a part of a larger political, cultural, educational, economic, and social infrastructure put to solidify, closely as solidifying the village's worldviews. African-American women who live outside of Oyutunji Village's heteronormative understanding of partnership and in other ways, in other areas of North America, they speak about Yoruba tradition as being one of the few religious spaces for them that was compatible to their lifestyles as practicing Yoruba priests and also lesbians, being in loving same-sex units. Regarding sexual orientation, the understanding of Yoruba religion is that, one priest said, the gods don't discriminate, people do. It is a religious place where African-American women practitioners seek to have all of their layers of identity, including African-American and lesbian, be acknowledged, one practitioner said. One African-American woman concluded, quote, spirit don't look at who you're sleeping with, spirit looks at what's within your heart. For those of you who read Karen McCarthy Brown's book, Mama Lola, she says that she has godchildren who are gay, who are lesbian, who are interested in Vodou or Orisha. She said on the issue of sexual orientation within these traditions, she explains, we do spiritual work together. Then you close your door and I do not interfere. I'm not interested in their private lives, what they do behind closed doors. You do whatever you want with your body. That's not my business. And what I do is not others' business either. That's my life. I'm a mother, not a private detective. In Vodou, everyone's equal. In Orisha, we're equal. End quote. Because there are religions that are practiced not only in North America, but throughout South America and the Caribbean, one Afro-Cuban woman in my research stated, I am who I am. You shouldn't love or not love someone because he is or is not homosexual. Likewise, if you go to the saints with a problem that you want resolved, the saint is not going to consider whether or not you're homosexual before he or she helps you. They don't look at you as a homosexual. They look at you as a human being. In addition to providing new cultural practices, spaces for multiple orientations, and affirmation for a whole being, many African American women are mostly drawn to Yoruba tradition for its divination services and for offering alternative modes of healing. This is a picture about maybe four decades old of the founder of Oyutunji Village with one of his clients, and he's on the mat doing divination for her. Within my research among Yoruba American communities, I analyzed divination as a mediatorial language and a mode of communication negotiated through a vast array of mystical technologies. One scholar defined divination as a way of knowing the views and intentions of the supernatural world. The divinatory relationship is a cooperative struggle of the divinity and human person to achieve a good end in one's daily life. It engages an anthropocentric ontology, where existence is viewed in terms of its connection to humans. Human destiny is negotiable, and human agency is a chief negotiator with the natural and spiritual worlds. The morphology of divination includes examination, consultation or reading, diagnosis, and ultimately prescription. Divination also shares a complex relationship with oracular literature or sacred oracles, and its spiritual prescriptions seek to appease, neutralize, or invoke supernatural assistance. Prescriptions might include herbal medicine where the human body is the site for healing, such as ingestion or bathing or topical salves or healing soaps or remedies that require supplicative appeasements to spiritual entities, such as incantations or prayers or food offerings or initiatory rites, and in some instances, the deities might require animal sacrifice. In an interview with one African-American woman who was in a ceremony, a healing ceremony involving sacrifice, she reflected on both her Christian background and what it meant for her to be part of this tradition and how she looked at the meaning of sacrifice within both traditions. She said, after having to kill a goat, when I went back and I read Abraham and Isaac, I really had a much different picture in my mind. If you have ever seen a sacrifice, you know how horrible Abraham must have felt that he had to tie his son up and attempt to do this ritual with his son. I mean, it is horrifying. The crucifixion of Jesus became much more meaningful because I have seen sacrifice. I might not have understood the mercy of that had I not gone through a Yoruba sacrificial tradition. You're actually there when the blood is being spilt, and you realize that something has given its life for you in a very real way because you see that life go. It's not something you walk into lightly, and I think you just need to do right because you don't want anything to have to give up its life because you did some trifling stuff. Clients enter this world of divination seeking.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, and we were listening to Tracy Hux, PhD Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Halford College, and she was speaking about the, she has a book out called The Yoruba Tradition, an African-American Religion, Religious Nationalism. And we're going to be speaking with Standish Willis and Gerald Horn very, very shortly. But first, we wanted to play a few silly little love songs. We are going to play some music from LSG, Levert, Gerald Levert. I guess he passed away a couple of years ago, but his birthday was a couple of days ago, so we're going to listen to Gerald Levert, Keith Sweat, and Johnny Gill. We're also going to hear from Toronto's own Deborah Cox, and one of my favorite singers is Joe. And we're going to begin with LSG and Door Number One.
Must be behind door number one, the panic in the jungle. Must be behind door number two, something special for you.
Special for you.
Must be behind door number three,
ooh-wee,
fulfill your fantasies.
All your fantasies.
girls get the mood right, 'cause it's your body. Ooh. I wanna fulfill. Don't think I'm half crazy. Baby, I'm for real. Look behind the door.
Number two, baby, number one. Could walk you through the jungle.
See how do what I ever.
It's amazing how you knock me off my feet. Every time you come around me, I get weak. Oh, yeah. Nobody ever made me feel this way. Oh. You kiss my lips and then you take my breath away. So I wanna know. Understood what you were worth. No. And he never took the time to make it work.
You deserve more love than
no. Baby, I'm the kind of man who shows concern. Yes, I do. Any way that I can please you, let me learn. So I won't go.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Jalali Norman Otis Richmond speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, here in the not-so-great White North, playing some music that will get you in trouble. I just stole that from Nairobinga, Zimbabwe, who is teching today, and I'd like to thank him for handling the technical show today. Last week we ran out of time and we thanked him, but
It was too late, so he didn't get credit last week, but he's on the buttons again today. But we heard from Joe, I Want to Know. We also heard from Toronto's own Deborah Cox, Nobody's Supposed to Be Here, and LSG. That's Gerald Levert, Keith Sweat, and one of my favorites, Johnny Gill, and Door Number One. Right now, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn and Standish Kwame Willis, a lawyer who was born and he's based in Chicago. He does a lot of work around the question of torture, and we're going to be speaking to them about Charles Roach, a great lawyer here in Toronto, Canada. And the connection between both of these gentlemen and Charles Roach is Charles Roach is an attorney. Gerald Horn was an attorney. Stan Willis still is an attorney. But all of them shared time together in Cuba. So right now we wanted to play two artists from Cuba, Benny Moray and Cecilia Cruz. This is Benny Moray.
Perla, mi amigo, ahora le diré por qué. Una cienfuegra me dijo Benny Moray en una tarde de mayo, allá por Pasacaballo, con el rumbo a Rancho Luna. Y ella me dio una fortuna en amores, y en cienfuegos me quedé, ya tú lo choca en la orilla, mi hermana, de la roca que lo apaga. Me gustó ver cómo encaja el escambray en el llano. Me gustó el techo de guano donde Guajiro nací. Pero lo que más me gustó a mí, si el fuego un pueblo cubano, tú lo ves.
¡Azúcar otra vez! Muchas gracias. Muchísimas gracias. Ok, yo quería, maestro Isidro, cuando usted me empezó a tocar el número, yo iba a practicar mi inglés y no pude hacerlo, así que ahora le voy a decir, ladies and gentlemen, para los que no me entienden. It is a great pleasure to be here with you tonight. Thank you for coming. Remember that my English is not very good looking, but I am very glad to say that. Enjoy the show, okay? Vaya. Muchas gracias. Vámonos. Todo aquel que piensa que la vida es desigual tiene que saber que no es así, que la vida es una hermosura. Hay que vivirla toda.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to some music from Cuba, Celia Cruz and Benny Morey, and we're going to talk with Dr. Gerald Horn and Standish Kwame Willis. And Dr. Horn is the Morris Professor of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston, and he is the author of a brand new book called Negro Comrades of the Crown. And Standish Kwame Willis is a criminal defense attorney who was born in his base, and he is based in Chicago, and he's doing a lot of work around the question of torture in Chicago. But today we wanted to talk about Charles Roach, who is an attorney in Toronto, Canada, who was born in Trinidad and Tobago, and he is suffering, or he is facing some health challenges, and there is a committee called the Al Hamilton Tribute Committee. We are putting on a tribute to Charles Roach at the Train Studios in Toronto on August the 21st. And I wanted to, I guess, begin with Dr. Horn, and then I'll ask Stan Willis the same question about when did you meet Charles Roach, and what is your relationship with Charles Roach, beginning with Gerald?
Well, I met him some decades ago. We were both active in the National Conference of Black Lawyers, which was founded in Virginia, USA, in 1968. An organization of activists, lawyers, and attorneys, and Charles Roach was basically our main Canadian contact and leader. We went to Cuba together in a delegation a few years after the founding of the organization. We collaborated in 1985 on an important conference that took place in Toronto that brought together jurists and lawyers from all over the Pan-African world to confer on matters of mutual interest, and he played a pivotal role in that particular effort, as he played a pivotal role over the decades in the activities of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. Of course, even before he participated in that organization, he had been active in various matters involving the law in his home city, that is Toronto, establishing a sterling reputation as a practitioner, not only in matters of immigration law, but in matters of criminal law and matters of what might be called activist law, generally speaking. He also established a reputation, as you well know, as being an anti-monarchist. As you know, technically, if not actually, in Canada, the sovereign is still considered to be the Queen in London, which many have taken umbrage to, and Charles was amongst those in the forefront of that. So I think that when the history of this period is written, Charles Roach will merit more than a footnote, and I salute those involved in Canada in honoring his very multifaceted legacy.
Mr. Willis, Standish Kwame Willis, when and how did you meet Charles?
I met Charles also as a member of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I didn't start practicing until very late in life, so I didn't start practicing until 1983. So I missed the early days that Gerald refers to. But I was the chair of the National Conference of Black Lawyers Chicago chapter for several years. We had a very active and very strong chapter starting probably in 85 or thereabouts. And so I met Charles Roach doing the work that NCBL was doing at the time, doing some very progressive work, very active in the anti-colonial struggle, very active in the 80s in the anti-apartheid struggle here in the States. And indeed stayed in touch with liberation leaders on the continent throughout that time period. NCBL was very active in staying in touch internationally with various progressive groups in different countries. Then, like many members of NCBL. We would meet at conferences, and we stayed in touch generally by phone and later by internet. I would say in the last 5 years or so, I got to know Charlie very differently. Charlie invited me and my fiance to come to Toronto, and I believe this was in 2007 or 8 or something like that. And he said, you need to come to Toronto because this would be a great way for you to get some rest. And, of course, I was very anxious to get some rest. We were leading a struggle against police torture here in Chicago, which was eventually taken and internationalized and went before the UN around it, and et cetera. So I went there, you know, thinking I was going to get some rest. I was there about 3 or 4 days. And while I was there, I met you, Norman. I was on your show, on the radio show. I spoke at a major gathering at a church.
United Church,
in
right?
other words, the rest that Charlie had in mind was the kind of rest I usually get.
He put you to work, huh?
He did. It was a wonderful trip. And it gave me a chance, because I stayed with him and his wife, June, at their house, at their apartment. So it gave me, and I got a chance to meet their children. I knew Charlie's children. They were older. So I got a chance to meet June's children and their babies, and we spent a lot of time together. And then after that, I was invited to Trinidad. Charlie's really from Trinidad, and June's from Trinidad. So I went to Trinidad, me and my fiancé, on 2 separate occasions. And so we had a chance to spend a lot of time really getting to know each other, talking about, I'm a civil rights lawyer primarily. But I do criminal defense work as well, but most of my work is police brutality work. And he's very interested in that part of it, but he's also very interested in the fact that I always made it my business to stay close to my base here in Chicago, which is African-American community. So I was always organizing town hall meetings and kind of mobilizing in the community. He's very interested in that aspect of the work. So Charlie is not only a great lawyer, he's a mentor. Charlie is an artist. I didn't realize that until, you know, I got to know him in the late years. I mean, he's a fantastic artist. He shows his paintings. He has shows with his paintings. He sings at every conference. Charlie sings, and he has a good voice, and he leads us in various songs. And he writes poetry. You know, he's a fantastic, he's almost what we used to call a Renaissance man. He's a brilliant guy. So that's kind of how I know Charlie, you know, and I'm wishing him well. He's a gem, you know. We love Charlie.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn and Standish Kwame Willis, and I wanted to ask Gerald and Standish a question about Charles's international work. Now, Charles has been a defender of the Cuban Five. He has been very strong on the whole question of, rights for the Palestinians. And he's been really hard. He's not a fan of Buckingham Palace. I mean, the monarch question, he's like Gerald pointed out. But could you talk about, beginning with Gerald, some of Charles's, the whole question of Cuba, the Cuban Five, and Palestine?
Well, this is something I think needs to be underscored. And sadly, this trend that once reigned in North America of cross-border relations between Africans on the south side of this border and Africans on the north side, which led directly to the disintegration of slavery in the 19th century, disintegrated to a certain degree over the years, although you may recall that when W.E.B. Du Bois and his comrades organized the Niagara Movement in approximately 1905, they organized it on the Canadian side of the Niagara Falls border, which tends to remind us that for the longest on this side of the border, we had drawn sustenance from Canada, and somehow that has withered away. I think it's because after the rise of the civil rights movement and the according of a certain kind of citizenship, I guess some felt that part of the bargain was liquidating our international and cross-border ties. But we in the National Conference of Black Lawyers did not take that point of view, and as noted, Charles Roach was our major contact on the north side of this border that separates the United States from Canada. As noted, we worked together on many Cuban issues over the decades, including the Cuban Five issue, these political prisoners from Cuba who have been imprisoned of late because of campaigning against, quote, terrorism, unquote, from the United States launched towards Cuba. And we also campaigned quite a bit on Caribbean matters. I recall, for example, the brevity of the Grenadian Revolution, 1979 to 1983, and the role in particular of the late Morris Bishop. And I recall him coming to Canada. And, of course, Norman, you need to chime in here because some of this history you yourself were involved in, for example, when Caldwell Taylor and Morris Bishop and all the Grenadian comrades were in and out of Toronto and liaising with Charles. Actually, let me let you chime in on this point.
Well, Morris Bishop stayed with a brother by the name of Lenny Flary, and Lenny Flary has a niece that's part of the Uhuru movement, and Charles Roach, you know, he basically, between me, you, and the lampposts, Charles Roach put on two baby showers for my son Malik. I mean, I know Charles Roach very, 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 very well, and Charles, you know, this whole, the question of the monarchy, he is really causing a stir in Canada. I mean, he's in the paper constantly around the monarch question. But, the question of Grenada, we work with him on Grenada. The Palestine question, there's a lot of African people don't, there's a split within our community in terms of whether or not we should support the Palestine. Some of our folks are sort of conflicted on that, but Charles is a great person. I can't say enough about Charles Roach because he is he's always there for you, even if you're not even for yourself. He'll stand up for you, and you won't even stand up for yourself. And let me leave it at that.
Indeed. Let me just add in terms of the Cuban question. Charles and NCBL and many of us who were activists in the anti-apartheid movement and the anti-colonial movement in the 70s and 80s got to know Cuba very differently. We recognize and applaud the solidarity that the Cubans displayed for the African liberation movement. It was the Cubans, for example, that went to fight off the South African invasion of Angola in the mid-80s, where they had decided to topple the progressive, newly developed government in Angola. And it was Cuban troops who were mostly of African descent who went over and became engaged with the Angolan troops and defeated the South African army, which in some people's view contributed to the demise of the apartheid regime. And we applauded, we supported, we understood it. We've always been in solidarity with the Cubans because it was not just in Angola. They were instrumental in different parts of the liberation struggles in Africa. And so, you know, Charlie in the movement in Toronto around the Cuban Five, we have a similar movement in the United States. We certainly have one here in Chicago where we are in solidarity, very strong solidarity here in Chicago, very strong solidarity for the Palestinian people. We have been for a long time during the anti-colonial struggles, solidarity developed with the, to some extent, with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and that, you know, continued in some ways. So we had a very different view, and many people did during that time period. Certainly NCDL did, and Charlie did. And so being in solidarity with the Cuban Five, we had, for example, a big, not a meeting, but a discussion in an art center about 6 weeks ago where I spoke on behalf of the Cuban Five. And this is on behalf of NCDL. In Chicago and in parts of Minneapolis, the FBI has been attacking solidarity members, particularly those in solidarity with Palestinians, through the grand jury. I'm part of a group of lawyers who have been fighting on behalf of the local Palestinian solidarity people to push back because of the solidarity that developed during that time period. So that's Charlie's, that's Charlie's way of thinking. I mean, Charlie's strong in solidarity with many groups of people that have been oppressed and are fighting for right to self-determination. So that's Charlie. I mean, that's the epitome of Charlie.
Let me say, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn and Standish Kwame Willis, and I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about the fact that, you know, one of the things that Charlie was involved in when I first came to Toronto, he was supporting Panthers, Black Panthers, and I was never a member of the Panthers. I would have been, but I was run out of California, and I became a member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and Charles Roach was really big on supporting primarily Panthers, but other people that came from the liberation movements, the Black Liberation Movement in the United States, who were seeking refuge in Canada. And Charles Roach was a big fan of Rosa Parks and Martin King. And also, I think, could you talk about some of the other Caribbean lawyers that were involved in the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I'm thinking about Lennox Hines, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, Lennox Hines, of course, who's also of Trinidadian extraction,
right,
was a prime mover of the NCBL, which raises the whole Trinidad question. I think, as is well known in the Pan-African movement, for various historical reasons, those of Trinidadian extraction, it played a pivotal role over the centuries, going back to Henry Sylvester Williams,
correct,
a barrister,
right,
of Trinidadian extraction, who could fairly be considered, along with Du Bois, as the founder of the Pan-African movement over 112 years ago, and in fact exemplified Pan-Africanism by actually going to practice law in South Africa 112 years ago, right during the midst of the so-called Boer War. And not only that, but Eric Williams, the former prime minister, author of Capitalism and Slavery, C.L.R. James, of course, with Black Jacobins, which will forever stand the test of time. Claudia Jones, subject of a biography by Carol Boyce Davis, who played a pivotal role in the communist movement in the United States and in the U.K., a founder of the
Carnival.
West Indian Carnival in London, which is still with us, and also a founder of a newspaper there. Actually, you could even go back to the previous century when Britain was fighting for contesting other colonial powers for control of Trinidad. What happened is that after Britain gained control of Trinidad approximately 200 years ago, you have a number of U.S. Negroes who decide to fight against the United States during the War of 1812, whose bicentennial we're marking, at least Canadians are marking, it's going unremarked this side of the border. And what happens is that, particularly after the plundering and sacking and burning of the White House in August 1814 and the threatening of Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York, you had a lot of the Negroes who participated in that action, taking out their vengeance against the United States, then escaped and moved en masse to Trinidad, where their descendants continue to reside. They're known as the Americans. And that community, of course, has produced a number of militants. And so when you speak of Charles Roach as being Trinidadian, I think it's very important to have this sort of historical context in mind. That is to say, his militancy, his activism, it's his, but it's not his alone. He's a fruit of a very fertile tree.
Standish, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I just said, and I totally agree with Gerald, when you talk about the Black Panther Party, you know, we had a strong party here in Chicago. I wasn't a member of the Black Panther Party. I was more active with the more militant student movement on various campuses. But I knew Fred Hampton, who was the chairman of the party, and I knew the party officials here in Illinois. And bringing in the other, you know, Trinidadians or other people from the various islands, Lennox Hines, and I'm reminded of this, I filed a petition as part of Universal Periodic Review before the United Nations, where the United States was reviewed in 2010. And I filed a petition raising the imprisonment of COINTELPRO prisoners. Most of them were members of the Black Panther Party. And we talked about in that petition how our government, the United States government, had attacked that party, had trumped up charges, had murdered many of its members, including Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And I was reminded, and I didn't know this at the time, that the petition I filed wasn't the first petition. Lennox Hines from Trinidad Tobago had filed a petition back in the late 80s raising the COINTELPRO prison issue before the United Nations. So indeed, the connection between people in this hemisphere, people of African descent, go way, way back at many levels. And indeed, the connections go way back to struggles in South Africa and on the continent. I'm part of a group this year called the Chicago Midwest Centenary, ANC Centenary Group, and we are formed to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the African National Congress. And we've had a number of forums and, you know, just trying to discuss the history of colonialism and trying to begin to discuss the history of neocolonialism. So that history is very deep. It's very deep, and it's good that we're having that discussion, because I think many of our youth need to be reminded, perhaps, that that history is there, so that they will at least have that to inform how they proceed in their struggle to carry our struggle to its final victorious conclusion.
Now, let me say that Hines, I think he defended Assata Shakur, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And going back to Mr. Williams, he also lived for a moment in Halifax or in Nova Scotia. And I'm doing some research right now. He was involved in the movement around hockey. I think, contrary to popular belief, I believe hockey was started by Africans here in, basically a First Nations sport, but I think the first professional hockey associations came out of Nova Scotia, and they were African people. And Mr. Williams had something to do with that. But in the few moments that we have left, we have about 8 minutes left, so I basically wanted Standish and Gerald to add whatever they wanted to add.
Well, Gerald, why don't you go ahead? I'll follow you.
Well, I mean, I just think it's very important, as is often said, to present people their roses while they can still smell them. And I think that this struggle is long and it's intense, and many of our soldiers fall on the battlefield. And many of our soldiers fall and they go unremarked, which is sad when you think about it. So I really want to salute the friends and comrades in Toronto who are celebrating Charles Roach while he can still smell the roses, because, like all of us, he won't be with us forever. And I think when we celebrate our warriors, what we're basically doing is providing an incentive for others to become warriors, as opposed to disincentives, which is what we face on a daily basis.
Yeah, correct. Now, we're having our salute on August the 21st at the Train Studio. There is a salute coming up next Sunday at the Medical Science Center in Toronto, University of Toronto, pardon me. there's a place called Ellington's. They're saluting Charles today and next week, and I think that the National Conference of Black Lawyers is doing something for Charles in October, Stan?
October. You have a national conference in Toronto to salute Charles, yes.
That's because you the organization took the position that they wanted to salute Charles Roach.
Exactly. We were planning on having a conference in Memphis, Tennessee, and our organizing committee was working on having it in Memphis. And when we learned that Charles was ill, we decided we need to be with Charles. So we shifted gears and we would be in Toronto. And I'll tell you, you know, my understanding of Charles Roach is ill, but I guarantee you, Charles Roach would be fighting on behalf of the people until the bare end. He's not going to give up. You may have to tie him down, because that's Charles. I mean, that's his very nature. He's a fighter. He's a theorist. And he's going to be fighting, and we'll be there fighting along with him.
Anything else, Dr. Horn?
No, just that I salute you and Luther Continuo.
All right, and thank you both for being a part of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and I'm looking forward to having both of you back on the show at another time, and I definitely need to talk to Mr. Willis about the torture cases. We have you can give me 2 minutes about where the torture cases stand. We have a few seconds on that situation for Mr. Willis.
Yeah, very briefly, after 20 years of struggle of trying to get police officers that systematically tortured over 100 black men and sent them to prison, I convinced my colleagues to take the case international to put pressure on the American government, and we did. I was in Geneva, Switzerland in 2008, and shortly after going to Geneva, Switzerland and appearing before the CIR Committee, the Committee to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, and we appeared before the Committee Against Torture, the U.S. Attorney indicted the lead member of the torture group, John Burge. It's not over. We were preparing a petition for reparations for the victims and their families. And so the town hall meeting I had on Thursday was to bring my community together to give them a count of the work and to get more support as we go forward. So the struggle continues here around the torture case. It has international attention at this point. And I want to say, you know, I salute you, Norm. I also salute you, Gerald. I kind of keep up with some of the work you're doing. You have always done, important, spectacular work, and I admire you for the work that both of you all are doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual.
Take care.
And I guess we're going to let both of these gentlemen go, and we have about 5 minutes left, but we'll talk to you gentlemen very, very soon. And one more plug for Gerald, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire, Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. Any other book you wanted to promote?
No, I think that's enough. Thank you very much.
All right. And thank you for listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And Binga has been the technician, Naya Binga, Zimbabwe. And we can put on a little bit of music, Binga, and ease on out of here. All right. Take care. Yeah, Binga, are you there? Gerald, are you there?